Okay, so we're gonna see a couple of very important results and implications. We're gonna begin with Steinspring dilation theorem. First of all, let me define the purification of a state that you've already seen in, I think, tutorials. We say that the state rho A is purified by psi AB if rho A is the partial trace of some pure state in higher dimension, right? Make sense? Okay. Now, let's take a look at this theorem that I wrote here. It's called Steinspring dilation theorem. It tells you that given a CPTP map, familiar with a CPTP, means, I don't know if you've seen it probably in tutorials or in quantum classes, it's complete positive trace preserving map. Now, what is the importance in quantum mechanics of CPTP maps? Who can tell me? Let's see if you've seen it. Yeah?
They preserve probabilities.
They preserve probabilities for sure, but not only, right? They are maps that map density operators to density operators, meaning that is the kind of map that models any physically thinkable operation, right, on a state. Make sense? This is all the physical operations that you can do on a state, everything that you can think of, all right? From locking them in a room to plugging them into a wall, to throw them out the balcony, everything that you can think of that can happen to a state is a CPTP map. Make sense? All right. So we have a map that maps density operators to density operators. Then there exists a Hilbert space, HAB, right? And then a state that I call here 0AB, that for every state rho A, such that every state, not such that, for every state rho A, we have that a CPTP map, any CPTP map. So for every T, T of rho A can be understood as some unitary operation in a larger dimensional Hilbert space acting on a pure state, then taking the partial trace. Make sense? Every CPTP map can be understood as a unitary operation on a larger purification of a state, on a larger pure state in a larger Hilbert space. Make sense? Now, if you're talking a finite dimensional Hilbert space, the dimension of the Hilbert space where the state 0AB lives has to be at least dimension h square. Okay, is the theorem understood? Any questions? We're gonna interpret that theorem now. Does that make sense for everybody? Now, this is big. Several corollaries out of this theorem. Number one, well, if you see a mixed state, you can always think, say, think of, for example, the identity map here. If you see a mixed state, it means that there exists some pure state, whatever you want, some pure state, that is the purification of rho. So you can purify every single state, no matter what. Make sense? The second is that any operation that I do to a state can be understood as a unitary operation on the state and its environment, calling the environment whatever I don't see. And at least the environment has to have the dimension larger or equal than the square of the dimension of the Hilbert space where that state lives. Make sense? Okay. Why is this big? Well, is that understood? Yeah, so it is big because there is something called, or if you want, this is a point in philosophy again, the church of the larger Hilbert space. What is the church of the larger Hilbert space? Well, it's a direct interpretational point out of this theorem, in meaning like, so mixedness in a state represents ignorance, right? Agreed? So mixedness represents ignorance. Remember, when I put a black ball and a white ball in a bag and I tell you to pick one and I don't look at mine, you know, I just have ignorance about the state. Make sense? So mixedness represents ignorance. Thermal states, I just don't know the exact state. It's a distribution, probability distribution. If I probe the state, it's a classical probability distribution, etc. Mixedness represents ignorance. What this tells you is that you can think of ignorance mixedness, as being the consequence of entanglement. By that meaning, well, the reason that you have a mixed state is because you're not looking at the whole system. If you consider the whole universe, whatever that is, or the larger super universe, whatever that is, include the environment of that, right? There will be a pure state that you, no one know you, but the God that knows the whole universe, if you want, would know. And that state that is pure is entangled between the thing that you can see and the rest of the universe, meaning that, well, all ignorance in the world that you can think of can be understood, at least mathematically, as entanglement in order to heal the space. See what I mean? So there's no really such thing as ignorance as a fundamental notion. Rather, ignorance is emergent from the fact that there's entanglement with things that you don't see. How is that? That is a lot, huh? What I'm telling you is that every time you don't know something, because of entanglement, with something else. At least mathematically, this is not an opinable thing. Theorem, you can think of it like that, mathematically. Whether you interpret it like that or not, it's a step of philosophy, if you want. Make sense? So in the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space, what we would say is that, well, what happens is that systems lose information to the environment by getting entangled with things, and that's why you see mixedness, ignorance. Does that make sense? How do you feel about it? So either in the universe there's no ignorance whatsoever, or ignorance is a fundamental thing that is always there for some reason. But quantum mechanics cannot destroy information or create it. You know that, right? Quantum mechanics, the best that quantum mechanics can do to erase information is a paper shredder. You can scramble information. You can't destroy it. Questions? Anybody? Yeah.
What about an infinite dimensional?
Oh, this applies as well.
Because then you're doubling infinity.
Yeah, no, that's no problem. The same dimension. You can purify with the same dimension. It depends what kind of infinity. It depends if you're in a QFT or you are in a harmonic oscillator kind of things. But no, the theorem applies as well. Yep.
I think it's related to what you said just now. If we had a state representing the entire universe, like everything, would it necessarily be pure, or could we purify it?
You can purify it. So if you go to the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space, if you tell me in the universe there's a fundamental mixed state, somebody would say, well, I wouldn't call that the universe. It must be a larger universe where that is pure, because I can always think of that. And this theorem, you can pair it together with Wheeler the Wheat, if you want. You know, when you write things like this, have you seen that equation before? I mean, this is beyond the course here, but just maybe just a little parenthesis, and after class, if you want, we can discuss it. This equation is beautiful in many ways. This is thought of as the pure state, as if you want, the state of the universe. People would say sometimes the wave function of the universe, the state of the universe. And this equation is basically telling you, well, the universe globally, there's no time. There's no such thing as time. This is an attempt to try to understand time from the quantum perspective, the first one that was done. And it's like, well, there's no such thing as time. The universe is in an eigenstate of whatever the Hamiltonian for that universe is, right? The way to actually understand that is more or less a constraint, but whatever. Let's just say these words like this. The universe is in that state. So there's no notion. There's no change. The universe doesn't come with time. Time is weird. You know that, right? Hopefully. Time is a weird thing. It's difficult to define time. Very difficult. Why do we have something like the second law? Thermodynamics seems to be empirical. What's the definition of time? If you treat and look at the universe geometrically, time-like directions are special with respect to any of the others, right? Why is time so tough? Well, this is telling you, well, time doesn't exist, really. Time is emergent. So it's like saying, imagine in a system of two harmonic oscillators, right? So you have two harmonic oscillators that are coupled, XX coupling here, huh? So the Hamiltonian of this would be the sum p squared over 2m plus m omega squared x squared for each of those, plus an interaction term, which is, x1 minus x2 squared. So coupling strength, lambda, right? Which is the strength of that string. If you cool down, say it's a system of quantum harmonic oscillators, you cool it down to absolute zero. The ground state of this, is it no excitations in both oscillators? For example, I have the Fock basis, let me just write it here, right? I have the Fock basis for the first harmonic oscillator, the Fock basis for the second. Question: is the global ground state this? This would be the ground state at absolute zero of that system, right? When you cool it down. My question is it this? What do you think? Meaning, like, if I measure one oscillator or measure the other, they're going to be in the respective ground state. Is that right or not? What do you think? Opinions? No opinions? Yeah.
Classically, I think so.
Classically, yes, but I'm not asking classically. Yeah, classically, absolute zero, there's no motion in any of the oscillators. Quantumly, quick argument. What is the Hamiltonian of that? Well, you have a p squared I divided by 2m, say the same mass, right? Plus m omega, same, the same omega, just to simplify things, square xi, right? Plus lambda x1 minus x2 square, right? That would be the Hamiltonian. Mm. The whole Hamiltonian, well, this term in particular, does not commute with that one. And in fact, the commutator of these two is full rank, meaning that there's no sector where they commute in the Hilbert space. In the whole Hilbert space, they don't commute. Okay, so the total Hamiltonian does not commute with the free Hamiltonians. If they don't commute with the free Hamiltonians, that means that you cannot diagonalize them in the same basis. And there's no sector in the Hilbert space where they can. These are eigenstates of the free ones. This is an eigenstate of the total one. They cannot be the same, right? Because the Hamiltonians cannot be diagonalized in the same basis. So no, that's not right. That cannot be the case. In fact, if you compute the actual ground state, which you can, it's very easy, all right? I do it with undergrads, this thing. It's finding normal modes of this Hamiltonian, and you can do it. If you compute the ground state, you're going to find out that the ground state is actually a two-mode squeeze state. It's an entangled state between the two harmonic oscillators. That means, right, that first of all, that means that if I look at one of them, it's not going to be in the local ground state, if you want. If I look at one of them, right, if I look at both of them, I don't see motion, absolute zero. It's the ground state, nothing moves stationary, right? If I look at one of them, though, I'm going to see excitations. This is the popular science trope, right, that you say, well, in the quantum vacuum of a quantum field theory, if you look with a magnifying glass strong enough, you're going to see particles popping in and out of existence all the time. Have you heard that? Well, what that is telling you is that, yeah, the eigenstates of the local Hamiltonians are not the same as the eigenstate of the global Hamiltonians. Make sense? That's number one. Number two is, there is no notion of time evolution in the total state, all right? But when you look at a partial state, you may see evolution, but it's an illusion a little bit. There's no evolution in total. It's the fact that you don't have access to all the system. Make sense? That's what this tells you. Time is not real. Time is emerging, and emerging because of, well, when we don't look at the whole universe, we look at a part of the universe and we call the rest environment, and there's interactions between them. And those interactions between them, the change that we see in those interactions between them, because we don't have the big picture, is the notion of time, the emergence of time, and comes with laws of thermodynamics and everything. Again, this is philosophy. I'm not telling you a scientific fact, right? But it's kind of beautiful, and it connects very well with this. Make sense, everybody? The notion of time as an emergent thing coming out of interaction, not really existing as a fundamental thing, is an illusion that we see because of our inability to look at the big picture. Same as somebody looks at this oscillator in this case only, but not the whole thing. Make sense? Yeah.
Yeah, I just had a question about the first part of the definition of purification. Uh-huh. A state rho is said to be purified when this happens, and also when rho is squared equals to rho, I guess, because...
Yeah, then, yeah, for sure. It's very easy. Just tensor it with whatever, and that's the purification. Yeah. Maybe I should say a mixed state just to make it easier. There you go. Now you have no problem. Make sense, everybody? So this has these deep implications. It's a mathematical statement that you can always purify a mixed state and then understand the mixedness as entanglement. Right? Make sense? And the church of the larger Hilbert space, what it does is, let's take it to the extreme, saying that, if you see mixedness, it's because there's a larger universe where that is entanglement. Make sense? I like the church of the larger Hilbert space, myself. But it's a matter of opinions. There are some people that believe that mixedness is somewhat fundamental. There are some people that believe that it's not. I don't see any reason why it should be. And that's why I'm a priest in that church. Makes sense, but we don't get tax benefits if you're asking. So,
Why is it greater than or equal rather than equal in the dimensional?
Ah, because, well, to purify a qubit, you need another qubit at least. That's what this is telling you.
You're saying at least, but are there cases where you need more than what you've got?
No, you can always do it. The construction just tells you, no, you don't need more. So you can always purify with dimension square, but you can always purify with more.
Okay, so that greater than or equal could be an equal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's all, you can always find a purification where that's an equal. Make sense? That's guaranteed to be. All right. Nice. This is the first of the two dilation theorems that we're going to see in this course. And both of them have very fundamental implications. This is the least fun of them, so be prepared. The other one involves measurements. Okay, this is just about states, but the other one is about measurements. All right, any questions before we move? Is it clear? Is the message clear? And the fun that this has in terms of interpretational power? Huh? Very important for quantum info as well. All right. So it's the fact that it's a theorem that makes it so appealing, right? Because it's like, ignorance. Oh, but this ignorance is because I'm stupid, not because of entanglement. And somebody would say, well, there's a theorem that tells you that you can think of that stupidity as entanglement, and then maybe you feel better, you know? That makes sense? I definitely do. Oh, because I'm a priest in the church. You need to believe in order, it's faith that relieves you from your burdens, right, in this case. All right. Anyway, jokes aside, let's talk about measurements now. Now, measurements are a complicated thing in quantum mechanics. In fact, people didn't quite understand measurements at the beginning of quantum mechanics and how to model them. And we needed von Neumann to actually arrive. For many things in quantum, we needed von Neumann to arrive and say, hey, why don't you do this like properly, right? But the thing that was doing the worst, if you want, before von Neumann was, how do we model measurements, right? So let's talk about measurements. Let's define a measurement first, right? Quantum measurement. And by quantum, I don't mean that the measurement is special. It's a measurement of a quantum system. Huh? That's what I mean here by quantum measurements. Okay. All right. So, a measurement of a quantum system is a map from a quantum state rho to a set of real numbers accompanied by an update rule for the post-measurement state. Right, so we have a quantum state. Some experimentalist makes a measurement. The experimentalist writes down the result, and the state has changed as a result of the measurement as well. Make sense? The second part is very important because we need to guarantee compatibility between consecutive experiments. Think Stenger-Lack, right? You measure the spin of an electron, but then you measure it right after. It should be true that you get the same. If you obtain an eigenstate of a value that is associated with an eigenstate of the operator you measure in, if you measure again, you should obtain the same one. Basically, if you want, not because of logic, because experiments tell you so. Make sense? You need compatibility between consecutive experiments. Does that make sense? Now, implementing this is complicated. And maybe you're familiar with the notion of projective measurements. Well, maybe, I'm sure you're familiar with the notion of projective measurements. Projective measurements is, well, yeah, if you're measuring some self-adjoint operator and observable associated with some self-adjoint operator and you get a 7, then you update the state by applying the projector 7 on the eigenstate 7. Now, there are several problems with that. Problem number one. Problem number one is, well, leave aside relativity or any considerations. What kind of, you know, I feel like a measurement, right, should not be very different from an interaction, right? In a way, I am coupling a measurement apparatus to my system, and they interact, they exchange information, right? And that's what makes the measurement. But if the measurement is a projector, the problem is that I kind of think of a projector in general as the result of an interaction of a measurement device with an apparatus. Maybe you are lucky somehow, and that, because remember, most projectors to begin with are not unitary. Projectors are self-adjoint, not unitary necessarily. So you cannot model it as some time evolution between with a Hamiltonian. Well, maybe you can with an environment or something like that. But if you model the measurement as well, my measurement apparatus is interacting with my system and an environment, and the whole thing is unitary, right? Steinspring theorem tells you that it would be. The problem is that very rarely you would get projective measurements as a result of that. It's a zero measure set among all the possible interactions. And it so happens that no matter how you measure something, you are measuring the same way, you update the same way. If I measure something with a particular apparatus, but I use a different one that measures the same quantity and get the same result, you apply the same projector. So it's inconsistent to model everything as projective measurements. Projective measurements are created at two categories of physical systems. We have regular quantum systems, right, for which the rules of quantum mechanics apply, and measurement apparatuses, for which the rules of quantum mechanics don't apply, and they do projective measurements. See what I mean? You are singling out the measurement apparatus as something very special, for which, no, it doesn't couple unitarily to an environment and the system. It's just a projective measurement. Does that make sense? That makes sense, everybody? Isn't that weird, though? Are you happy with that? So then we be able to model the measurement as the interaction with a detector somehow, and the system, and the measurement apparatus should also be a quantum mechanical system. Wouldn't that be better? And let me tell you, we'll see the theorem later on when we see Neimark's theorem, right? But in fact, you're going to prove the second dilation theorem, or at least sketch a proof in either assignment or tutorial. I don't remember right now. But I can tell you the result already. You cannot just model things unitarily with an environment. So if I want to model a detector as a general quantum system that couples unitarily to the environment and the other system, the result on the system will never be, or will in general not be, a projective measurement. Make sense? Is that clear, more or less, that projective measurements are problematic like that? Does that make sense? Okay. Projective measurements are weird, yeah.
Should they necessarily be unitary? Of course, the system and we know and low unitarity, but.
Well, you have Steinspring theorem, right?
Yes.
That tells you that with the environment, it should be. If you consider the measurement apparatus, the environment, and the system, it should be unitary. If the system is the apparatus is quantum, certainly. Steinspring theorem tells you that, the measurement map, whatever it is, should be a unitary in a larger Hilbert space. If the apparatus is quantum, which you expect it to be, in a sense, by quantum I mean subject to the laws of quantum mechanics. Not in a quantum state that is very quantum or anything. No, I mean if you can describe it to quantum mechanics. See what I mean? All right, so projective measurements are bad, in a way. Let alone what happens with, I have a little presentation that I don't know if I'll do today, probably more or less, more so the next lecture. But when you put relativity in, you have an issue. In QFT, projective measurements are even worse. Projective measurements can be proven to mess up the causal structure of space-time, no matter what you do, okay? So they're incompatible, and we will see it. I'll give you a little presentation. We will see it. In fact, it was Raphael Sorkin here at Perimeter that was the first person to realize of that, okay? But you can already tell, right? If you apply a projective measurement, it's kind of you're updating a state. If it's bipartite, you're updating it instantaneously somehow, right? And people would tell you in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, it doesn't matter because the information about the measurement takes time to get to the other person, right? And things like that. Yeah, no, that's not, when you model things with QFT, that's not enough. Because you need your model to be fundamentally causal. We will talk about it. But yeah, projective measurements are problematic. Do we agree? I'm not saying that maybe some measurements can be modeled as projective measurements. Maybe some can. But in general, no, that's bad. I cannot postulate that when I measure an observable, I just update with a projective measurement and then be happy that the measurement apparatuses are also quantum systems. Make sense? So again, compatibility with relativity aside, note, asterisk, it's not compatible with relativity, but forget about the asterisk for a second. It causes a self-consistency problem in quantum mechanics, in which you need to treat measurement apparatuses differently than you treat everything else, instead of other quantum systems, if you go with just projective measurements. Make sense? Okay, so if projective measurements are not fully satisfactory in order to describe measurements of quantum systems in general, we need a more general framework that generalizes projective measurements, and maybe hope that that does. Okay? Disclaimer. Yeah, it kind of will, but there will always be a philosophical issue. The measurement problem is not a solved thing, so we're going to discuss it, the measurement problem in quantum mechanics and the implications of it when we see the generalization of projective measurements. Okay? Let's see the notion of POVMs. Let me give you a new postulate of quantum mechanics. Postulate 4. Measurements of a quantum system are represented by a set of operators Mn acting on the Hilbert space of the system one per each possible outcome of the measurement. This is actually important. Imagine that you're measuring another problem of projective measurements. Imagine that you're measuring the spin 1/2 particle, the spin of a spin 1/2 particle. And then you have an experimental setup with two lights. If light number one lits, that means that it's spin up, okay? In the basis that you're measuring. If light number two lits, it's spin down. But sometimes it happens that both lights light, and then you know, because you've done the experiment, when both do, you know the probability is 75% up, 25% down. Can happen, experiments are not perfect. Sometimes you get dark counts, sometimes you get a failure in readouts, right? But that doesn't mean you don't have information. That's a measurement, no? If both lights lit, it's still a measurement, it's the outcome of a measurement. You have three possible outcomes, let's say. Is the result a projective measurement in that case? No. Does that make sense, everybody? Projective measurements are pretty insufficient to describe a general measurement outcome. Does it make sense that you can have not just, if you measure a qubit, right, you don't have two possible outcomes. You can have seven because your experiment is not perfect.
But that's because the experiment is not perfect.
Right? Still, you need to model that measure. It's a measurement. That doesn't mean that you get no information. That doesn't mean you should throw out experiments that are not perfect, because otherwise there would be no experimentalists. See what I mean? So again, I'm telling you, imagine that light number one lits, and that means I know exactly the result, is this. Light number two lits, I know the result, is the other one. None of them do. Well, then I say, let's say it's 50-50, I don't know. Both of them do. Well, in that case, I know it's very likely that it's up, but not down. I don't want to throw that out, that's valuable statistics, I'm getting information, but I cannot model that with projective measurements, the state update after that. Make sense? Everybody? Seeing limitations of projective measurements to model like real scenarios. If you do weak measurements that don't give you full information about the system, but partial information that you should not neglect. Because if you have partial information and you do the experiment many times, you're going to get a lot of information. Make sense? The need to go beyond projective measurements hopefully is evident. Yeah.
Just a clarification. If you start with a pure state and you do a measurement, can you get a mixed state?
Certainly. Yes. in the scenario that I gave you, one of the possible results would be a mixed state. Make sense? So you can think, you see, you're going towards generalizing PBMs already to standardized PBMs. You would say, oh, maybe you should apply a probabilistic combination of two projectors. Well, that's a case of non-projective measurement that would be a PBM. PBMs are still more general than that, but that's one case, you see? In the case that both lie with a particular probability, that is telling you, well, with this probability, I apply this projector to update. With this other, I apply this other one. Make sense? Good, good. So, important. Possible outcomes of the measurements are not the same as possible values, possible eigenvalues of the observable that you're measuring. Could be more. Could be less. Could be more. Make sense? It's the possible outcomes of the measurements. That satisfies. That satisfies several, of course. The sum of all of them. Is the identity. So all that you can do, all the possible outcomes, if you combine them, you get nothing, obviously. So that means that there's a possible outcome per, so you always, the number of all possible outcomes cover the 100% of all the cases that you can have in an experiment. Make sense? All right. Wow. Let's give the update rule. If the system is in a state psi, the probability, so we need two things, of course. We need the probability of getting an outcome and the update rule. Those are the two ingredients that we need. Make sense? So the probability of getting outcome n is pn psi m dagger n mn psi, and the state after the measurement is updated as, so psi prime would be m n square root of psi m n dagger m n psi. Make sense? That's the update rule. So we call the operators EN defined as M dagger and MN. You see, what really characterizes these M's, right, in practice is you have a unitary freedom in these M's, right, that is not defined. It's like free to choose. So the important physical things are these guys, which of course means that the sum over N of EN is the identity. We call those POBM elements. So this is what characterizes the experiment, the set of EMs. And this means, POBM means positive operator is a positive operator, obviously. As you can tell, it's the modulus square. Of M, makes sense. positive operator, operator valued measures. Now, don't be confused with by the name. These measures here is not related to measurements. It's related to a Borel measure, to the fact that they are a measure in a way. They're like weights for a sum, in a way. So this is not related to measurement. It's a measure in the mathematical sense. It's like, well, I'm giving you a measure for summing a set of things, and the measure is operator value. That's where the name comes from. Make sense? It's a mathematically origin name, and it's a common mistake among people who are learning this to say operator value measurements. No, measure. Different thing. Make sense? Well, I hope the definition makes sense. We're going to say it in practice. We're going to give examples, right? But the idea is that, well, I told you, see how projective measurements are a particular case of that? If I get eigenprojectors, right? If my E's or my M's, doesn't matter, eigenprojectors, well, this would be self-adjoint and actually idempotent, meaning that the M dagger is equal to M if it's a projector, right? And also P squared is equal to P if it's a projector. So the E's and the M's would be projectors, and that's a particular case. They adapt to identity, the eigenprojectors of a self-adjoint operator. So projective measurements are a particular case of P of the M's. Make sense? And what we say here is that, well, we allow generalization of this to perhaps obtaining more different measurement outcomes, right? As we said, for example, one case of an imperfect experiment would be modeled by that. But we're going to see an example in which, it's the opposite. Having an imperfect experiment is good rather than bad. You'll be able to say more things about a particular quantum measurement scenario if you have an imperfect experiment modeled by a POVM than if you had access to all PVMs that you can. I will see an experiment now. But any questions about this? Yeah.
So the operators M are not unitary.
No.
Themselves.
No.
The operator C as well, unless we somehow.
The operators E are not unitary. No.
Yeah. So what is unitary then?
Wait until the next theorem. But yeah, so. But I can give you a spoiler if you want. The spoiler is that we can understand when you actually do consider your measurement apparatus to be to be a quantum system and a unitary interaction with the system and the environment, and then you measure the measurement apparatus with a PVM, the update rule on the system, you measure with a PVM, with a projective measurement, the apparatus. But of course, you want the update rule on the system, then you can prove it's a POVM in general, not a projective measurement. So if I were to treat my detector as a quantum system, but also a system that I can measure with PVMs, with projective measurements, then the update rule on the system that you're measuring will not be a projective measurement. It would be a POVM in general. But again, that's a spoiler. We'll see it in detail and what it means, because you may think, oh, but then you move the problem to, yeah, yes, we did. And we'll talk about that. Hopefully that makes sense. It's a little spoiler, though. We will definitely see it in depth. Any more questions? Is this understood? This is a new. So if you ask me why, I mean, it's certainly to model these kinds of things. You see that PVMs are part of this, right? This generalizes PVM. So at least the measurements that you've seen are included in here. But if you ask too much, I can always say, oh, postulate, which means that I don't really need to justify too much other than, well, we see that it works to model experiments. Don't worry, we will justify it, huh? But keep in mind that the level of that statement, the gravitas of that statement, is a postulate. We consider as a fundamental starting point for the theory. Make sense? All right. Good, good. Let's give an example before, and we know that experiments, again, well, I already told you, experiments not always will give you a definite answer to measuring something. Sometimes will give you partial information, right? And projective measurements cannot update the state with partial information. Then you may be clever and say, well, maybe, you know, a probabilistic combination of projectors, yeah, that would work. That's a POVM, indeed. You can have a POVM being that. Let's give an example. Can you, imagine you're given this problem. You're experimentalist now, right? Can you, or rather, you're the theoreticians that advise an experimental group how to spend their money. A lot of responsibility there. Can you distinguish between psi 1, say you have a qubit, psi 1 is that state, And psi 2 is 1 over root 2, 0 plus 1, in a single shot experiment.
I have one question. Mm-hmm. So just to clarify.
Yeah.
So by Stier-Spring deletion theorem, we showed that like measurement, if we take into account our system, our measurement device, and also environment, should be unitary. But this postulate is because of our ignorance of this environment and of these degrees of freedom. So it's some kind of effective operators that we came up with. So what's the measurement problem at all?
We will see it when we see the next dilation theorem.
Okay.
The measurement problem is that you still need to model measurements. You still want your universe to be fully unitary. That's not enough. You need something else. And we will see this when we see the next dilation theorem, because the next dilation theorem is about the theorem that tells you that POVMs are actually the real set of measurements. You don't need anything else. What assumptions do you need for that to be true? And one of them is just a partial solution to the measurement problem. And by partial, I mean that it just postpones the problem, moves it to, it's called the Heisenberg cut. But we will talk about that. I would say to fully answer that question, just allow me to next lecture.
Okay.
And we will answer it on Monday. All right. Makes sense, everybody? No, that's good. Those are all good questions. And this is the important thing. This is very foundational to understand if we have a measurement problem or not, or what kind of problem it is. Okay. Now, this is a more practical application. I give you two states, and I want you to distinguish them. Now, there's no, as you can tell, there's no perfect solution for this already. I mean, again, I would lie if I tell you there's an experiment that would do it. But there are experiments that are better than others at doing it. Say if you have only a single shot, meaning like it's very expensive to do this, I want to maximize my chances to be able to tell with only one experiment. All right? And I want to make sure that I can distinguish both. Because obviously, if you do projective measurements, if you get a one, then you, in the result, you know that you have that one. But you can never distinguish that one if you have it. If you have the zero, you would never be able to tell that you have the zero. I want an experiment that is able to tell, at least sometimes, that is the zero. Make sense? This experiment cannot tell with projective measurements. If you say, oh, just measure the observable, with projective measurements, you will never be able to tell it's psi 1. Sometimes you will be able to tell it's psi 2. But you will never be able to tell it's psi 1. Make sense? All right. So we could write the probabilities for the projective measurements, but let me write like that. Scenario 1. PVMs. PVMs are projective projector valued measures, same as positive operators. You see, we have replaced the projectors by positive operators. Make sense? The E's are the positive operators. The POVM elements are the positive operators. That are projectors, but not only. More general set. Okay. Scenario 1, PVMs. So let's do projective measurements. Well, in that case, we have, if we obtain the probability of getting a zero with the state psi 1, is of course the norm psi 1 0 square, and that's 1. If you get psi 1, you get a zero with probability 1, right? The probability of getting a 1 or a 0, let's say, with psi 2, which of course is psi 2 0, is 1/2. The probability of getting a 1 with psi 1 is, again, same thing, 0. And the probability of getting a 1 with psi 2, right, is 1/2. So there are two possible outcomes. That's outcome 1, that's outcome 2. If you get outcome 2, then you know that you are with Psi2, and you would distinguish 50% of the time that you are with Psi2, right? Well, in fact, if you measure a 1, if you measure a 1, what is this? Yeah, if you measure a 1, you know that the probability that you have Psi1 is 0, right? And that's 50% of the time, if you have an equal distribution of both states. But if you get a 0, you cannot tell. You have a probability of 50% of being one or the other, which is full ignorance between the set of the two. Make sense? So this test will be able to distinguish if you have Psi2, but it will never be able to tell you a Psi1 and doesn't give you any information if you have one or the other, if the 50% of the time, if the outcome is 0. Make sense, everybody? All right. Let's do a scenario. So that's the simplest experiment. I don't think they would have hired a theoretician just to do that. There are better ways of doing this. Or at least, again, there's no perfect way, but ways that have different payouts, if you want. Let's do a scenario with POVMs. Maybe I'll do it in a different board. Scenario 2. There's a POVM scenario. It's not even the optimal one. It's just an example. Let's build these three possible POVM elements. That's what characterizes. So we're going to have an experiment with three outcomes. Number one. This is the first POVM element. So there's outcome one, that's that. Then there's outcome two. That's going to be and of course, outcome three. Agreed? Those are the three possible outcomes of my measurement. I designed this as a different experiment that has these POVM elements. Make sense? All right. So now let's do the same. Let's do the same construction. You can tell already that measuring one more, and we will do the same construction before. Probability of getting a one with the state psi one. Well, that is psi one e one psi one, right, by the postulate. And that is zero. Probability of getting a one when it's psi two. So this is Psi2, E2, or Psi1, sorry. Ah, with Psi2, my bad. Psi2. And that is 1 over root 2 plus 1. Probability of getting a 2 with Psi1. Okay, so same thing. Psi1, E2. Psi1, and that is 1 minus 1 over root 2. Probability of getting a 2 with Psi2. That is Psi2, E2, Psi2. And that is 0. Probability of getting a 3 with Psi1 is again Psi1, E3, Psi1, and that's going to be 1 over root 2. And finally, probability of getting a 3 with Psi2, which is Psi2, E3, Psi2. And that thing is 1 minus 1 over root 2 plus 1. All right, so if the lab builds an experiment that can be modeled with these three POVMs, so you can tell what it is now. These are not a probabilistic sum of projectors, right? Because in terms of orthogonal projectors, because this thing it looks like a projector, right? It's not normalized properly. I don't care, because in general, all that I want is that this happens, right? But this is proportional to a projector, but it's proportional to a projector over a state that's not orthogonal to it, to the previous one, agreed? With PVMs, you're always limited to orthogonal. They're self-adjoint operators, right? So they are projectors on orthogonal spaces. This is not, and experimentally, this is not difficult to think what it would be. Oh, this is kind of a regular measurement of the spin, and this is kind of a regular measurement of the spin, but rotated a bit. Make sense, everybody? And then it's a very simple POVM. It's basically saying, well, I can measure either one or a slightly rotated Sanger-Lach. And of course, the third outcome is that, well, I don't know what it was. The third outcome, I don't care. If I don't get a measurement out of those, I would get anything else. I put it in this drawer. That's what I mean. I could have more drawers, right? I could have more of these. But I did it just with three. Okay, so what do we obtain? So possible outcomes. This is what happens if you get outcome one. This is what happens if you get outcome two. And this is what happens if you get outcome three. If you get outcome one, you know for sure that your state is psi two. Agreed? If you get outcome two, you know for sure that the state is psi one. If you get outcome three, you don't know. Well, you do have some information, right? Because this number is larger than this number. So you know that you're likely to be maybe in psi one, but you know what? We can just even be like that. If you get the outcome three, throw it out. So this is an experiment that will actually return inconclusive many times, but when it works and distinguish both. This is able to tell, to distinguish psi one and psi two, whereas the PVM scenario would never be able to distinguish that you are in psi one. This one is. We paid a price though. We have now negative outcomes, like dark counts, inconclusive results, right? Again, it's not purely inconclusive, even for this one. You get some information. Sure, you also get some information here. That's why I'm just saying that. Let's make it inconclusive, right? So you pay the price of some probability of getting inconclusive results. But this experiment, for sure, when it works, it will distinguish. This one will not. Make sense, everybody? So you see, having a faulty experiment, it's not that bad. It may not be faulty. It may be like cleverly designed. I'm not measuring orthogonal things. Makes sense? I have non-orthogonal states to distinguish. So maybe the way to go is not measuring orthogonal, not doing orthogonal projections, right? Any questions? So this is just an example of how POVMs can be better sometimes. Now, if I wanted to get rid, so imagine that it's a more dimensions, so more superposition. If I wanted to diminish the probability of that, just create more cases here that can distinguish both, right? Because that would make this one more inconclusive. So you can, this is not optimal. This is one with three outcomes that I came out of, like, out of doing it, right? Like saying, like, it's not even optimized. But if you were a theoretician, maybe you're paid to optimize over all possible POVMs that are achievable with our lab, such that this is minimized and you can still distinguish. Make sense, everybody?
That must be empty hard as well, right?
It is, yeah. But you have approximate solutions, maybe. I mean, if you're clever, a theoretician. Luckily, I don't work for the lab, so I can afford to just come up with the easiest and just throw it to you. But this illustrates, right, that you pay a price of, well, there's some probability the experiment fails, but when it works, or it really distinguishes both. Something that this doesn't. Make sense? All right, let me just, before going, let me just write the last dilation theorem, the one that, and we start with the philosophy about in the definition about in the next lecture. Let me write the last dilation theorem. Now we will see. Well, and I'm going to write not the theorem. The theorem is actually more powerful than what I'm going to write. But to discuss that, I just need a corollary out of the theorem. OK? Let me write it. And this is the corollary that you will prove in an assignment or tutorial. I never remember. Bindija, do you remember if it's an assignment or tutorial? Oh, it's a tutorial then. Oh, then you'll do it today. It's very nice. So it's good that I give you the theorem. Consider the unitary evolution of a coupled system consisting of a detector the environment and a target system. Okay, so this is the scenario for a measurement, huh? We have a system that we want to measure, we call the target system. We have a detector that we couple to it to measure it. And then we have everything else in the universe that we call the environment. Make sense? Oops. Ooh. I just lost it. Sorry about that. Internet sometimes is funny. There we go. Then the action of a PVM on the detector always yields a POVM on the target system. There's a very big justification for the postulate for that I gave you. So let's think about it for a second. What this tells you, if I have a detector, an environment, and a target system, I couple the detector to the target system. Of course, both can be coupled to the environment. And after the interaction has finished, you know, I let it interact for a while, then I measure the detector, and I measure it with a projective measurement, okay? So if I measure the detector with a projective measurement, I would do an update that is a projective measurement. But the detector and the target would have interacted, they would have gotten entangled. In fact, most interactions in the world do create entanglement, right? So they get entangled also with the environment. Well, after doing the state update with a PVM, the target gets updated by a POVM. So what this is telling you, if I couple a detector that is quantum, but this detector, so what I call detector, I'm saying that I measure with a PVM. So detector is special still. It's as a quantum system that for which PVMs are good models for measurements. I'm singling out detectors here still. Still a quantum system, you see, it's not a measurement apparatus that is otherworldly, but it's special in the sense that, well, I want to be able to do a PVM on the detector still, a projective measurement as I know it. But what you see is that, well, the result of the measurement is a POVM. Let me put it like this. I couple a detector, then I read out the detector. When I read out the detector, I do a PVM on the detector's observable eigenbasis. Well, the system, the target system gets updated, but the update is not a PVM. It's a POVM. That already proves that PVM are insufficient to describe measurements on a target system. Because some of the results when you couple a detector and an environment are not going to be PVMs. They're POVMs in general. It doesn't solve the measurement problem because you can ask, well, how do you measure the detector then? It's also a quantum system. You have to measure it. You're trying to convince me that PVMs are not good, but you are still saying that you need one on the detector, right? Well, the short answer is that, well, let's just single out detectors as quantum systems that are simple enough so that PVMs are good models, right? And then you'll be done. But philosophers would not be happy with that, huh? Because still separating detectors from everything else. And we will talk about it in the next lecture. Any questions about this? Because you're going to prove this today. How excited are you to prove this? On a scale of 1 to 10. I would expect, okay, perfect. I would expect like a 7 or more. Eh? This is exciting stuff. This is very powerful. I hope that you see that this is extremely powerful. This is telling you that, first of all, I don't know, if you come from projective measurements being nice and used and so on, well, this is telling you, no. If you actually, you cannot, with PVMs, you cannot model this simple scenario. I have a detector. It couples unitarily with the system and the environment, okay? And then I measure the detector. What is the state update on the system? You would say, well, if all measurements could be described by PVMs, that should be a PVM. What this is telling you is, no, it's not a PVM. It's a POVM, actually. That's to begin with. And second is, this makes the divide between detectors, measurement apparatuses, and quantum systems less pronounced, right? Yeah, question.
Can you show that it is impossible to get a POVM on the system if you measure with a POVM on the detector?
You will also get a POVM. But then how do you measure? So you see, what you want here is that the POVM emerges from some, we'll talk in the next lecture about it. The problem is one of the aspects of the quantum to classical transitions, right? There are two aspects. This word is thrown around meaning two things, right? Quantum to classical could mean my system is too big and then I lose the quantum effects of the individual constituents. That's not what I mean here. They're related, of course, but I know what I mean. What I mean here is I have a probability distribution to begin with. Say something like psi 2, right? And I want to measure the observable for which eigenstates are 0 and 1, right? I have a probability distribution. I make a measurement. At some point, the quantum system goes from a probability distribution to some classical value or classical probability distribution. How does that happen? If I were to solve that, right, or from a probability distribution to a single value, how does that happen? What is the dynamics in my theory of quantum mechanics? How does that happen? Well, for the system, that's how it happens if you allow me to do PVMs on the detector. But the problem is that you can still ask, but how do you do PVMs on the detector? Maybe you do POVMs on the detector. What does that mean? Well, that means that I can think of it as coupling another system to the detector and doing a PVM on another system. And then you can ask, well, then who detects the detector of the detector? Instead, what you're asking, instead of a PVM, do a POVM. I need a number. You see, I need some experimentalists will write a number. How does that happen? That's what we call the Hasmer cut. At some point, we need to stop. And that's why the measurement problem is not solved. If it were, the coherence, so loss of information to the entanglement together with Neymar theorem would solve it. If the Hasmer cut wouldn't matter, right? You wouldn't worry about who measures the measure, right? Philosophers do, many physicists don't. So some physicists could say, well, that's it. I mean, you know, I just restrict myself to, I stop at the level that PVMs are good approximations for whatever system I use as a detector. And that's when I stop, they would tell you. But philosophers still tell you, but no, but still singling out some, you know, we can talk about that. And I will also show you some slides about the implications when you have a relativistic theory, in particular a QFT, and just some slides, just so you see what the problem gets worse when relativity comes in. Make sense? Hopefully you're excited for the tutorial then. It's a kind of outrageous statement, huh? Oh yeah, PVMs won't do it. It's POVMs. And that proof would justify postulate 4. Because you see, postulate 4 seems like you made it up. It could be that way, but it could be others. Well, no, if you really want that it emerges from the unitary interaction of detector and system and possibly an environment, this is the way to go, postulate 4. Make sense? Good, okay, I'll see you on Monday and good luck proving this. It's not difficult.